Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com.
Welcome to Straight No Chaser on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, and we are broadcasting live from the back of Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn at 261 Moore Street, where brunch is being served right now. My guests today are actually in studio. It's kind of weird, actually, to have so many people in the studio because I'm so used to having the phone-in guests lately. But I'm very happy to announce that today's program will be devoted to urban agriculture and... as such, we have a couple of pioneers and their crew in the studio today. Anastasia, totally forgot your last name.
Plakius.
Thank you.
Anastasia, it's forgettable. Plakius,
not at all, never. And Ben Flanner, who are two of the founders of the Brooklyn Grange, one of the most successful rooftop farming projects in the country, I suspect. I'm surprised you guys aren't like making mad money doing consulting work all over these states right now. That's your next project, start promoting what you know. And with them are two of their key new people, I think. Would you guys like to introduce yourselves?
Michael Meyer, farm manager this season.
Farm manager.
Ooh.
Wearing the mantle of greatness. And?
Chase Emmons, chief beekeeper and director of business development.
Oh, bees and business. I like that. It's all about bees and business, folks. So tell us, just give us a quick thumbnail, because we have talked about the Grange several times on this program in the past. You guys are gearing up for a new season, obviously. You have a new farm manager. So what's happening with the Grange? And then let's talk about something new in the works for the Grange folk. Tell us everything. Come on, farm manager. Let's hear what's happening.
We've got a new roof this season. It's going to be really exciting for us. We're expanding to a second location in the Brooklyn Navy Yard. We're going to have a second location. It's going to be about 1.5 times the space of our flagship farm.
And which is how big?
Just under an acre, 38,000 mm-hmm. square feet.
So you're going to be doing like an acre and a half of farming at the Brooklyn Navy Yard?
Yeah.
And is that going to be a rooftop experience also, or is that going to be on the ground level?
Nope. Rooftop again. I think this is the 11th floor, so we're moving on up in the world.
And how did the Brooklyn Navy Yard come to be your location of choice? What happened? Thank you, Ben. Ben Flanner
sure.
speaking.
This is Ben. Hey, great to be here, Katie.
Always good to have you here, Ben. I enjoy your company.
Well, we found the Navy Yards, and it was a place that had all these empty buildings, or empty roofs, at least, and a significant amount of area. And we basically approached them, and I think a couple other things happened in parallel, and then we started some meetings and basically reached an agreement that we were going to put up a rooftop farm pretty quickly.
Amazing. So you guys are in construction now for that project?
It will be starting very shortly.
Incredible. And do you have to do the same kind of... the engineering of the original Brooklyn Grange, you had to find a building that could support that much weight in terms of dirt and water. You were able to find a similarly constructed building that was able to manage the same thing, or do you have to do any retrofitting for that?
Sure. It's called Building Number 3, and it is plenty strong. It has a concrete roof deck and adequate spacing between the vertical columns and the girders and so forth. And the structural analysis has already been completed, so at this point... it's just a matter of getting the work done and getting the green roof system and the soil up on the roof.
Wow. And I forget what you guys told me, the amount of soil you had to put up for the flagship farm, but it was something really extraordinary, like in the form of several tons.
Yeah, it was just over 1 million pounds. And this will
more
be,
than, this will more be than several tons, 1 million pounds of dirt. Yeah, baby. Where do you get the dirt from?
It comes from a mushroom composting facility in Pennsylvania.
No kidding.
Yeah, it's essentially the product. They grow mushrooms in compost.
Yeah.
And then they take the completed product and they continue to break that down. They have huge windrows. Chase and I went out there last fall. It was a great field trip. Just huge piles of steam all over the place.
Yeah, I would imagine.
And then they continue to break it down. They monitor the compost a bit, and they come up with a good product. They give it to farmers, landscapers, and then sort of merged into the green roof business where they blend it with lightweight stone and then also sell that.
Mm-hmm. And do you have to pay for this, right?
We do, yeah.
Is that like a big part of your financial... you know, undertaking here is paying for the million plus pounds of soil. What does a pound of soil go for?
I'd have to think about it per pound.
Okay.
It's how a little over a little over $150 per yard.
Per yard? Oh, you measure it by the yard. Interesting. Yeah. I didn't realize that. Very cool. So are you guys going to grow the same kind of crops there that you grow in the original farm?
In general, yes. We're always experimenting. There'll be different, you know, we're testing new chicories and different types of heirloom tomatoes constantly. But in general, it'll be consistent, but also kind of allow us to take it to the next level in terms of rotating our crops and having different crops growing at each farm. We can almost start treating each farm like a separate field, mm-hmm. which will really allow us to mature our farming practices in terms of dealing with pest and disease problems in case there's an insect invasion of some sort or a mold or a fungus or anything like that.
Just out of curiosity, do you guys use only sort of heirloom quality seeds, or do you are you buying commercially available non-Monsanto seeds?
Yeah, we focus exclusively on, you know, open pollinated and heirloom seeds where we can. Mm-hmm. So the majority of our seeds we purchase from Johnny's Seed Company or Fedco. For some of the specialty heirloom crops that we get. Especially with Anastasia here, who is kind of our key into the food world and what's cool and hot, like Spigarello or Agretti last season, we'll get those from small-scale foreign companies.
I also make this is Anastasia now, I make an annual pilgrimage with my folks out to the Baker's Creek Heirloom Seed Bank in Petaluma, California.
It literally is an ex-bank.
Yeah, and they have 12,000, well, actually, my first visit, they had 12,000. I think they've upped it from there. Different cultivars available. And so it's always kind of this, like, you know, it feels like those old programs where you have like 10 minutes to spend like $100 and you're just grabbing things. And so I go in there and it's always kind of overwhelming to pick out the couple things that strike me the most. And Ben always gets these frantic calls from me about various seeds.
Can we grow this?
Yeah.
What the heck is this? Looks
imagine.
Good.
Yeah, right?
It's a dollar. Let's get
it. We're also doing something kind of cool with the seed saving project.
Yeah, I was going to add, that was my next question, is are you saving seeds? So what's happening with that? Because surely you must be feeding back into these seed banks, right?
Yeah, we do a bit of saving on our own, particularly with heirloom tomatoes, tomatillos, certain peppers, the aji dulces, for example. But then also we struck up a partnership with the great Zach Pickens this year, who has a new company that he started called Rooftop Ready. And he's actually been experimenting with it for a few years now. And he claims to have made some significant strides, especially with lettuces and things like that, where he saves in the traditional strategy of finding the plants that are the most successful in their environment, allowing those to go to seed, saving those seeds, and then starting a new generation. And then over time, with several generations, you end up with something that's better adapted to both New York, urban environment, as well as a rooftop.
Oh, how interesting. So it's pretty cool. Yeah, that's very cool. Now, you guys, your new project is, part of it is about a stormwater management, or part of the money that you've raised or managed to secure for this project is about managing stormwater. And what's that all about? I mean, tell us how you got into that and what it means and why do we care whether stormwater is managed?
Yeah, I mean we're living at this point in a city whose sewer system was built well before a period of rapid development. So when New York City's sewer system was built, there was a lot more green space available, and rainwater was absorbed at a much greater rate. And now with all of these non-porous surfaces, all this concrete that's been added, you know, there's just a lot more water entering the sewer systems, and the combined sewage overflow has become a real problem for not just New York City, but a lot of cities out there. So now everybody's looking to different creative ways to manage stormwater. A big one is green roofs, and an intensive green roof with deeper soil like ours that can support edible plants really absorb a tremendous amount of stormwater, more so than an extensive green roof, just, you know, a little sedum green roof that you might have up on a roof. So we're really excited to be working with the Department of Environmental Protection, and Brooklyn Navy Yard will be managing 1 million gallons of stormwater at the Navy Yard farm.
And just one note on the Navy Yard farm, we were awarded a grant from the Department of Environmental Protection, which is going to pay about 75% of the installation cost as a program and a grant application that they had for creative projects which catch stormwater, mm-hmm. particularly in the case of thunderstorms and quick, heavy rainstorms. That's their prime focus.
Fascinating. Go ahead.
And this season, actually, we'll be working on a project with a couple of folks from Pratt. Who'll be actually studying and having hard, you know, data come back on the stormwater management that actually happens with the farm. There's been some speculation that with a traditional green roof, that more stormwater is managed because there's usually less need to irrigate. And since we're a farm, a lot of critics of rooftop agriculture have said, well, if you're adding more water to the system, you're actually not mitigating as much water as you otherwise would. And some pretty smart folks have said, well, maybe that's not the case, because if you're growing, say, tomatoes, which are, you know, a high percentage of water, you're actually pulling much more out of the system. Mm-hmm. So we'll have some cool facts and figures on that later this year.
And do you capture the water so that you use it in subsequent, you know, periods when it's dry, for instance? Do you have, like, cisterns, or how is that managed?
We don't have cisterns on the flagship farm, but the green roof system we use is extremely efficient in holding some rainwater that's not absorbed by our soil. Of course, with, you know, a rooftop farm, you want to make sure that your soil drains well. You don't want a lot of water sitting on the farm. So that water might drain through the soil, but there is a drainage mat. The second layer of our green roof is a drainage mat. It's a hard plastic, kind of looks like egg crates. And that'll hold 1 inch of water in reserve. So we are able to capture and use quite a bit of rainfall for our plants. The roots of the plants will actually just extend through the beds, through the top layer of felt in our green roof system, and wick that moisture back up from our drainage mats.
Cool. Fantastic. Now, you guys are very high tech. I'm telling you, it's mind blowing.
Next level. Started with the Germans, by the way.
Yeah. Oh, is that right?
Yeah.
Cool. So you guys have gotten quite a bit of support from the city, and particularly from Council Speaker Quinn, City Council Speaker.
She's been very supportive. She's been up to the farm along with Jimmy Von Bramer, our councilman in the neighborhood in Queens. And her staff's been great. They have the new Food Works program, so they're definitely focused on food policy and trying to increase, you know, improve people's diets and just the whole food system across the city. Including distribution. So I think what we're doing is very representative of the kind of forward thinking that they're pushing. So we're definitely aligned in our goals.
So absolutely. And is the mayor's office as well is supporting all of these activities? Do you guys have competition? Who else is doing this? Or are you the only ones?
Gotham Greens.
Yeah.
If you're aware of them, they just launched.
I've had them on the show several times.
Oh, great. Yeah. Viraj and Jen. They just launched their hydroponic greenhouse, as you know about, as they've been on the show.
Yeah. And that's also a 1 acre hydroponic project.
I think it's a bit less.
Is it? Oh, mm-hmm. Maybe 10,000 square? No.
It's like 15,000 square feet.
Yeah, that's what I thought.
A little less than half.
Yeah, because Jen, it was a couple of years that she was here, since she was here. So she came on with Dixon de Pommier. Like, it was one of the first shows that I did with Patrick when we first started the radio station, actually, was we had Dixon and Jen on, and they were just fantastic guests. Do you guys also work with the vertical farming community? Because there's quite a few people who are getting into that.
Yeah, actually, Dixon was at an event with me last week, so I got to catch up with him for a bit, first time in a long time. And then speaking of the vertical farm, there's a lot of that in the news, as many people may know. He's sort of the father, the visionary,
the big granddaddy of that.
Exactly. he was talking about the number of Google searches as they've gone from basically, like, if you Google vertical farm and you do it 10 years ago versus now, it's gone from like in the dozens or hundreds to like 50 million hits or something.
Amazing.
Like that. Will Allen in Milwaukee, also the kind of guru of urban agriculture, all things including aquaponics, hydroponics, soil composting, worms. He's the man. He just announced a plan or a goal of building a 5-story vertical farm in Milwaukee. So it'll be interesting to keep tabs on that project.
Absolutely. I'm going to follow up on that. I'd like to have him on the show sometime too. So, Jack, I think maybe we'll take like a 30-second sponsor drop now, and then we'll come back and talk about sort of the bigger picture of urban ag across the country, since we're talking vertical farms in Milwaukee now.
Today's program was brought to you by Fairway Market. Whether you are cooking for one or for a crowd, Fairway Market literally has everything you need for a fantastic meal. But if you don't feel like cooking, no worries, they cater. Check out fairwaymarket.com for more information, and be sure to check the new blog, On Our Plate, for weekly specials, health tips, and recipes.
Welcome back to Straight No Chaser on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, and in the studio with me today are the wunderkind behind the Brooklyn Grange. It's Anastasia
Plakius.
God.
You're going to get it.
I am going to get it. I just have to think of the sculptor, the early Greek sculptor, and then I will get it.
Yeah, it sort of sounds Greek and Italian at the same time.
It's totally Greek.
Just like me.
Yeah right. And Ben Flanner, of course, and then
Chase Emmons,
and Mike...
Michael Meyer.
Thank you, Michael Meyer. I'm sorry. You
know, sounds familiar.
International man of farming.
The international man of farm management.
Mysterious farming.
So one of the things you guys are doing, Chase, we were just talking in the break a little bit about the business of farming and whether or not that's going to become a viable... something that people can use in the city, not only to guarantee our food security, but also to generate new sources of revenue and food. And you're the business development man, and you're also the beekeeper.
Yes,
so
I wear two hats.
Bees are apparently beginning to show promise as a revenue stream for the Grange. Why don't you talk a little bit about your bee-saving bee program?
About my bee project?
And then also what business development means for you.
Sure. Business development and urban farming and rooftop farming is very interesting.
We'll get
to that. But the bees are pretty much, it's been a project of mine. Just I've been a beekeeper. I grew up born and raised in New York City, but spent a lot of time up in Massachusetts, got into beekeeping about 10 years ago, just on a lark. A friend of mine got a hive, and I'm like, what are you, crazy? Like stinging insects? Like, you're nuts. Mm. And after I checked it out for a few days, I was just like, I got to do this.
Do the bees love you?
Bees love anyone. We're happy to give them a nice, comfortable home and basically leave them alone.
Just like cats.
Yeah, actually, it's easier. Having a beehive is easier than having cats, guaranteed. Because I have cats too, so I can.
My cat is incredibly demanding of my time and attention.
And they don't give you honey, which is really a strike against them.
Yeah, you know.
And they do have a litter box, which is really a drag. Okay, so what do you do with the bees?
Well, beekeeping was actually illegal in New York City. In 1999, Giuliani made it illegal for no particular reason. There was like a list of several hundred animals you couldn't have in the city, and bees were on it. No one knew why. And the New York City beekeeping community spent 10 years getting it legalized again. Mm-hmm. So I was actually able to luck out from all their efforts and come on the scene right after it was legalized. So great. It's good for me. When I came across the Grange, I realized you guys got to have a few hives up here. So pretty much we set up 4 hives last season on the Grange, one on top of Bobo, which is a restaurant in Greenwich Village as well. And in our first season, we got over 300 pounds of honey, which is a sizable revenue stream when you really crunch the numbers.
Most definitely. I mean, your inputs are practically zero, right? It's just the hive.
Just time.
Yeah, there's some time. There's this slight capital up front of like buying the hives, buying the bees, but otherwise it's an incredibly profitable revenue stream. I mean, a revenue source. Return on investment is, gauged in weeks, months, not
Amazing.
Years.
Yeah.
So, and then it's like, you're right, they're there. The big trick is coming across bees that will then survive the winter.
and don't need a lot of inputs, hopefully no chemical inputs. And that's sort of like going along with our seed saving projects. We're starting a big, what we're calling New York City's first commercial apiary, though if anyone comes out of the woodwork and says, no, here's records of something else, fine, fair enough. But in the Navy Yards, we're going to have between 20 and 30 hives. And yeah, we're going to get honey. Yeah, it's a revenue generator. But part of that project is genetics. We want to raise bees that, it's kind of like any animal husbandry where, or with plants, where, you know, the ones that are most successful, you breed with the ones that are most successful and you get ones that are even more successful. And ultimately, in like 3 years or so, we hope to end up with what we call New York City genetics, mm-hmm. which will be bees that are just easy to take care of, really well adapted to the New York City environment, don't need chemical inputs, and people can actually then purchase bees from us as well, not just honey. Right now, everyone up in the Northeast purchases their bees from the southern states. So like Georgia, Florida, you know, you can't really get local bees unless you have a friend and they have a good hive and then you split their hive. But there's no real commercial source in the Northeast for bees. And we plan on changing that in the next few years.
Fantastic.
And that's part of our goal, because right now the survival rates are, they're decent, but they could be a lot higher. And especially from an animal husbandry point of view, you know, if you're raising a colony of something and, you know, and using its honey, you want to give it as much love as you can to get through the winter. So you know, ideally you want 100% survival rate. So the bees are 100%.
How do you get bees through the winter?
Well,
do they normally migrate out of the Northeast?
The normal cycle is that bees, like feral bees, essentially, the way bees live, they hibernate. And it's not really hibernate, they kind of go dormant. And really, it's a cool process because it's all about saving the queen. Mm-hmm. So in the fall, the queen raises a bunch of new workers that their sole purpose over the winter is to cluster around her in a ball, keep her warm, keep her fed. And that, it's like suicide mission. That ball gets smaller and smaller and smaller over the winter. And as long as she's alive and a couple of attendants, by the time it gets warm, it all starts all over again. Biggest problem is it gets really cold, or if they were stressed by disease before they went into the winter, if they didn't stock away enough honey. And this winter, actually, the warm winter we've had, counterintuitive, has been a bad thing, because the bees haven't gone as dormant as they could, so they've been eating through their food supplies a lot faster than normal.
So then do you have to supplement their feed?
Yeah, we supplement them with just straight sugar syrup. So mm-hmm. like 1-to-1 sugar syrup, nothing, you know, nothing else. But that's like a power bar to get them through the hard times.
Right. You were talking earlier about chemical inputs. What kind of chemical inputs do traditional beekeepers use? I mean, I had no idea that people were feeding their bees chemicals.
Well, yeah. So the way real commercial beekeepers really make their money is through pollination. Like honey is kind of superfluous to them. Mm-hmm. They travel around the country in trucks with thousands of hives, and they pollinate crop to crop to crop depending on the season.
I've heard that was what was causing colony collapse disorder. Is that correct?
You know, no one has. Every time someone thinks they figured out the quote unquote cause, they realize it's just one of many. It's really just a lot of stressors that people are putting on them. So these beekeepers make all their money out of pollination, which means keep the bees alive at all costs. So if they have a disease, they'll pump in antibiotics, they'll do whatever they have to do to like cure the bees long enough to get them to pollinate, to get paid, and then move on. As we know with any type of industrialized animal raising, the way we're doing in our culture, that just ends up creating a weaker and weaker population.
Interesting. Fascinating. Yeah. Jack, I heard many bites there, didn't you? That's for our daily bite. Jack and I produce these little one-minute food news things that are so much fun, and bee geekery is just part of the kind of thing that really makes me excited.
We're called Beaks, by the way.
Oh, thank you. That's fantastic. So when you talk about business development, what are some of the projects? I know Anastasia mentioned a couple of sort of nonprofit elements of your business model, but what are some of the things you're doing to sort of raise revenue and develop your business? Tell me what that means, actually, for you.
You know, one of the things is, as Ben will say, we're always being creative. We always have our eyes open for new potential revenue streams, because this is such new territory. We're pioneers. There isn't really a benchmark to gauge it against. It's not like, okay, you have to go do this or look at this market and be efficient in this market. It's really, there's no model to follow. Mm. So one of the biggest things, at least that I have in my head, is scoping new roofs and new revenue streams, actually new revenue sources, in order to finance building those roofs. Because we plan on building, hopefully, another big roof every year for the next few years.
Now, last year, I think, Ben, you told me you raised something like 15,000 pounds of product. Was that right?
Indeed.
And so when you more than double your thing, you'll have like 30, maybe close to 40,000 pounds.
Yeah, maybe mid-30s.
And so where are you, you're selling this all through CSAs and into restaurants, or are you going to start being able to produce enough product to get into supermarkets? What's the goal there?
Farmers markets, restaurants, mm-hmm. CSAs, and then also some, you know, potentially retail deliveries. Especially we'll start out with some of the smaller retailers around, particularly around Brooklyn and Queens.
Right. So you would be going into places like Fairway? Or is that too big?
We'll start even smaller than that, like Brooklyn Kitchen, Marlowe right. and Daughters, maybe Foragers, places mm-hmm. like that, that are a little bit you know, more family business types.
Right.
That yeah, we don't have a problem selling all of our produce. There's nothing left.
Yeah.
Another exciting revenue stream that we've kind of identified recently is our events program. A lot of people are looking for an interesting space to get married or have a 50th anniversary party, and there's just
as long as they don't touch the plants.
No touching the plants. No, it's
you break it, you bought it.
No getting drunk and falling into a bed.
It might have happened once or twice. But I'm particularly excited because we're actually there's an elevator being built right up to the farm. So this year, when we're doing events, it means I don't have to lug like you know pallets of chairs up two flights of stairs to get them up to the roof. So there's a wonderfully accessible event space right there for the booking. Everybody should email me to have their
party. And people could put a tent up if they need to and stuff. So
yeah, it's
all
beautiful.
Set up for that. Yeah.
Yeah, it's gorgeous.
That's great. And you didn't have to get any special licensing, or should I not even go there?
No, we do. Everything's above the board. You know, we apply for the liquor licenses and everything. Definitely like to keep it safe. But it's really wonderful. And Ben is as efficient of a farmer as he is. He's also a very aesthetically conscious farmer. And he last year planted sunflowers all along the parapet wall next to the table.
Good
so
move.
We would have these. Yeah, it was this beautiful sunset. Like, you know, the lights filtering through the petals of the sunflowers. And guests absolutely love it. You know, they spend most of the time just taking cell phone photos. But once they actually put the phone away and enjoy the evening, they always have a good time.
One other interesting revenue or sales test that we're doing is mushroom growing. We have 25 inoculated mushroom logs, thanks to Gwen and her workshop that she did late last summer. So they're inoculated with shiitake mycelium or spores, and we're going to test those. And we'll treat them just like any other vegetable, where we look at its yield per square foot that it takes up, and then how many dollars per pound do we get, what's it worth, and then is it worth maybe doubling or tripling or expanding the mushroom production next
very
year.
Interesting. And you guys could grow all kinds. You could grow hen of the woods on the up
exactly
like that.
Yeah.
I mean there's a lot of varieties that
shiitake's
would work
the
well.
Gateway
yeah absolutely.
There's also our value-added products. I mean,
yeah.
We make some clearly we bottle our honey and we make some candles out of our beeswax, but we've got hot sauces that are just outstanding.
They are, I can tell you. I've tried them. They're excellent.
And Anastasia's salsa verde.
Yeah, baby. Yes, yes. Let's take this up because we don't unfortunately have a whole lot more time. You are part of a movement that seems to be sweeping the nation. We were talking before the break about the vertical farming project in Milwaukee. I sent you guys an article that I picked up on the Seattle Food Forest that's just about to launch itself. 7 acres of readily available fruit trees, nut trees, herbs, and a variety of other products that are open to the public, which seems incredible to me. We'll see what happens with that. But there's all kinds of projects like this going across the country. And Michael, you were mentioning a few of them earlier before we came into the studio.
There's a whole lot kind of happening with urban and small scale agriculture right now that's pretty interesting. I mean, and they all complement each other in such great ways. You know, talking about the Seattle Edible Forest, I mean, 7 acres of, you know, permaculture based fruit and nut trees that people can go in and forage for themselves is a great idea. It's something that's in the same vein as what we're doing as a fiscally sustainable commercial business model for rooftop agriculture. And then you also look at all of the, you know, nonprofit organizations in the city and, you know, across the country that are dealing with food justice and food access issues. So, you know, from the nonprofit, NGO, corporate, I mean, there's just such great energy around farming right now. And looking at what's happening with the government in terms of funding and focusing on young farmers, this is really a better time than ever for people who are interested. You know, I mean, like myself, I'm 25. I left a cushy corporate job to become a farmer, and you know, I'm so enthused about the energy and the resources that are now being made available for young people who want to be farmers. You know, if you're interested, if you're a young person, you're interested in farming. You know, there are so many resources out there. National Young Farmers Coalition, etc. So.
And just another tidbit on that. Last week, in the middle of the snowstorm, Michael and I and Zach Pickens, the seed saver, went up to visit Elliot Coleman, the 73-year-old guru of small-scale organic farming. And he used an interesting analogy. He was speaking about the rate at which people have climbed El Capitan in California, comparing it with probably from the 60s or the 70s from his mountain climbing days, and said something. I'm going to get the time wrong, but he said that they climbed El Capitan in something like 42 hours, and recently it was climbed as low as like 3 hours or 2 hours or something like that. And he was optimistically predicting that the youthful energy that is getting into small scale farming is going to have a parallel improvement like that. So that was really exciting to hear from somebody as well respected as that.
One thing I will say, though, about all these exciting projects that are happening all over the country, especially things like the Seattle Food Forest, we really need to focus right now on educating the consumer and the community about sustainable agriculture, healthy eating. You know, without that knowledge, this access means nothing. So unless people know how to use these products, why they're important, why they're good for you, and that's, you know, that's something that, while we are really focused on being a commercial business at the Brooklyn Grange, we're also, you know, we do run an educational nonprofit called City Growers, and we bring youth up by the thousands every season to educate them about sustainability and urban agriculture and making healthy food choices. And I think that's just such an incredibly important aspect of what we're all doing. And Ben, who taught me everything I know about farming, is one of the most wonderful teachers. And this whole experience has taught me that every great farmer is also a great teacher.
I'm trying to make vegetables cool.
Yeah, man, make the vegetable cool. Well, it is an interesting conundrum. I mean, I know we mentioned this a few minutes ago, or just before the show, that and you certainly touched on it, and this is a mantra for me, but if we don't bring home ec back, if people don't know how to cook, if we don't teach kids right away that food is something that you make in your house, not that you buy already prepared for you, you know, as you say, this is all kind of irrelevant. It's just kind of a cool hobby. And, you know, I'm a strong proponent of bringing food back into the school system and making, and not just food, but shop. Hello, what about learning how to do basic stuff
make
around
stuff.
The house, man? I mean, it's just, it blows my mind that those skills are so quickly being lost after generations of Americans being so proud of their self-sustaining, you know, abilities and the, you know, their can-do attitude. And we've all turned into these lumps of, you know,
we hope
of incompetent fools, you know, who can't figure out how to boil a potato.
Yeah, but we might be experiencing the cultural shift now. Yesterday, Ben and I were at Hampshire College for a presentation, and Ben was trying to explain to the crowd what a CSA was, and they're all like, we know what a CSA is. And normally people are like, what's a CSA? Mm-hmm. They were just like, why are you even saying this?
Yeah, so, well, Hampshire, real representative sample there.
But, but even here in the city, we have
Hampshire students, please ignore her.
We have a great internship and apprenticeship and volunteer program. And, you know, there's just more people every day who come up to the farm. And I'm, you know, we're all very surprised sometimes by what they already know about farming and you know, food issues. So it's just great to see.
Well, I think it's a real, I mean, it's representative of the New York microcosm. I'm unfortunately not so confident that it has spread beyond the East or West coasts or the big cities. But, you know, you got to start somewhere, and you guys have certainly made a major start. Unfortunately, folks, we got to wrap this up. It's been a great pleasure to have you here in the studio. Please come back soon and let me know when the Brooklyn Navy Yard thing is online.
Thanks for having us, Katie.
Many thanks to the Brooklyn Grange. Many thanks to my sponsor and to my inimitable engineer, producer, and partner in crime, Jack Inslee. We'll see you next week, folks. We have the American Livestock Breed Conservancy is launching a program to employ veterans in raising livestock breeds. This is going to be a really interesting show. I'm very excited about having these people on. We have a farmer and somebody from the ALBC who will be joining me by the phone. So please do tune in next week to Straight No Chaser at 1 p.m. Thanks so much for listening. See you next week.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com
as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.